Jeremy runs amok, a dreadful discovery before dinner. Among the various manners of recovering from the neurasthenic tension that accompanies a drop, I must admit that the one old Abdul had laid on for us took first prize for decadent. That means good taste. It's hard to remain stressed out while reclining on a bed of silks in a pleasure palace on Mars, with nubile young squishies to drop pre-fermented grapes into your open mouth, your very own mouthboy to keep the hookah smoldering, and a clanky band plangently plucking its various organs in the far corner of the room. Dancers whirled and wiggled and undulated across the stage at the front of the hall, while a rather fetching young squishy lad in a gold lamé loincloth and peacock feather turban waited at my left shoulder to keep my cocktail glass from underflowing. Candied fruits and jellied European critoplankton of a most delightful consistency were of course provided. "What ho! This is the life, isn't it?" I observed in the general direction of Toadsworth. My bot buddy was parked adjacent to my bower, his knobbly mobility unit sucking luxuriously conditioned juice from a discreet outlet, while the still squishy bits of his internal anatomy slurped a remarkably subtle smoked Korean soy ale from a Kleinstein by way of a curly straw.
"Beep, beep," he responded.
Then, expansively and slowly,
"You seem a little melancholy about something, old chap. In fact, if you had hyperspectral imagers like me, you might notice you were a little drawn. Like this. Pip."
He said it so emphatically that even my buggy but priceless family heirloom amanuensis recognized it for an info burst and misfiled it somewhere.
"Indiscretions aside, if there's anything a cove can do to help you, enemies you want inebriating, planets you want conquering, feel free to ask the toadster what."
"You're a jolly fine fellow, and I may just do that," I said. "But I'm afraid it's probably nothing you can help with. I'm in a bit of a blue funk. Did you know Laura left me? She's done it before several times, of course, but she always comes back after the drop. Not this time, though. I haven't seen gear nor sprocket of her since the day before yesterday, and I'm getting a bit worried."
"I shall make inquiries right away, old chap. The clanky grapevine knows everything. If I may make so bold, she probably just felt the need to get away for a while and lube her flaps. She'll be back soon enough."
Toadsworth swiveled his ocular turret, monospectral emitters flashing brightly.
"Bottoms up!"
I made no comment on the evident fact that if the toadster ever did get himself arse over gripper, he'd be in big trouble righting himself, but merely raised my glass in salute. Then I frowned. It was empty.
"Boy, where's my drink?"
I glanced round. A furry brown sausage with two prominently flared nostrils was questing about the edge of the bower where my cocktail boy had been sitting a moment before.
"Grab that pachyderm!"
I shouted at the lad, but I fear it wasn't his fault. Jeremy had already done him a mischief, and he was doubled over in a ball under the nearest curtain, meeping pathetically. Jeremy sucked the remains of my Saturnian ring ice water margaritas up his nose with a ghastly slurping noise and winked at me. Then he sneezed explosively. An acrid eruption slapped my face.
"Vile creature," I raged. "What do you think you're doing?"
I'm told that I am usually quite good with small children and other animals, but I have a blind spot when it comes to Jeremy. He narrowed his eyes, splayed his ears wide, and emitted a triumphant, not to say alcohol-saturated, trumpet blast at me. "Got you," he seemed to be saying. "Why should you two legs have all the fun?" I made a grab for his front legs, but he was too fast for me, nipping right under my seat and out the other side, spiking my unmentionables on the way as I flailed around in search of something to throw at him.
"Right, that does it."
People to either side were turning to stare at me, wondering what was going on.
"I'm going to get you."
I managed to lever myself upright just in time to see Jeremy scramble out through one of the pointy-looking archways at the back of the hall, then found myself eyeball to hairy eyeball with Ibn Cutthroat's administrative assistant.
"Please do not make so much of a noise, Ralphie-san," said the junior under-vizier. "His Excellency has an announcement to make."
And it was true. Human flunkies were discreetly passing among the audience, attracting the guests' attention and quieting down the background of chit-chat. The band had settled down and was gently serenading us with its plucked vocal cords. I glanced after Jeremy one last time.
"I'll deal with you later,"
I muttered. Even by Jeremy's usual standards, this behavior was quite intolerable. If I didn't know better, I'd swear there was something up with the blighter. Then I looked back at the stage at the front of the room. The curtain sublimed in a showy flash of velvet smoke, revealing a high throne cradled in a bower of hydroponically rooted date palms. His Excellency Abdul Al-Matsumoto, younger sibling of the Emir of Mars, rose from his seat upon the throne. Naked eunuch bodyguards, their skins oiled and gleaming, raised their katanas in salute to either side.
"My friends," old Abdul droned in a remarkably un-Abdul-like monotone, "it makes me more happy than I can tell you to welcome you all to my humble retreat tonight."
Abdul wore robes of blinding white cotton and a broad gold chain, first prize for atmosphere diving from the club, I do believe. Behind him, a row of veiled figures in shapeless black robes nudged each other. His wives, I wondered, or his husbands.
"Tonight is the first of my 1,000 nights and one night," he continued,
looking more than slightly glassy-eyed.
"In honor of my sort of ancestor, the Sultan Shahryar, and in view of my now being, quote, too old to play the field, my elder brother, peace be unto him, has decreed a competition for my hand in marriage. For this night and the next 1,000, lucky concubines of every appropriate gender combination will vie for the opportunity to become my sole and most important sultana."
"That's right, it's not a date," added Ibn Cutthroat from the sidelines.
"I shall take the winner's hand in marriage, along with the rest of their body. The losers, well, that's too boring and tiresome to go into here, but they won't be writing any kiss-and-tell stories. If they forgot to make backups before entering the competition, that's not my problem. Meanwhile, I ask you to raise a toast with me to the first 7 aspiring princesses of Mars standing here behind me, and their intelligence and courage in taking up Scheherazade's wager."
He sounded bored out of his skull, as if his mind was very definitely busy elsewhere. Everyone raised a toast to the competitors, but I was losing my appetite even before Ibn Cutthroat stepped to the front of the stage to explain the terms of the competition, which would begin after the banquet. "I may come from a long line of Japanese pretenders to the throne of a sheep-stealing bandit laird, but we'd never consider anything remotely as bloodthirsty and medieval as this." The prospect of spending a night with dashing young Abdul gave a whole new and unwelcome meaning to losing your head for love, as I suppose befitted a pretender to the crown of Ibn Saud, never mind the Sassanid Empire, by way of Mitsubishi Heavy Industries.
"I don't think this is very funny," I mumbled to Toadsworth. "I wish Laura was here."
Toadsworth nudged me with his inebriator.
"I don't think you need to worry about that, old chap. I spy with my little hyperspectral telescopic dodger."
Ibn Cutthroat was coming to the climax of his spiel.
"Gaze upon the faces of the brave beauties," he crowed. "Ladies, drop your veils."
I gaped like a fool as the row of black-garbed femmes behind the prince threw back their veils and bared their faces to the audience. For there, in the middle of the row, was a familiar set of silver eyelashes.
"Isn't that your mistress, old boy?"
Toadsworth nudged me with his inebriator attachment.
"Jolly rum do, her showing up here, what?"
"But she can't be," I protested. "Laura can't be that stupid, and I always forget to remind her to take her backups, and left to her own devices she never remembers, so—"
"I'm afraid it's still her on the stage, old boy," commiserated the toadster. "There's no getting around it. Do you suppose she answered an advertisement or went through a talent agency?"
"She must have been on the rebound. This is all my fault," I lamented.
"I disagree, old fellow. She's not squishy enough to bounce. Not without pulverizing her head first, anyway."
I glanced up at the stage, despondent. The worst part of it was, this was all my fault. If I'd actually bothered to pull myself out of my pre-drop funk and talk to her, she wouldn't be standing on stage, glancing nervously at the court executioners on either side. Then I saw her turn her head. She was looking at me. She mouthed something, and it didn't take a genius of lip-reading to realize that she was saying, "Get me out of here."
"I'll rescue you, Laura," I promised,
collapsing in a heap of cushions. Then my mouth-boy stuck a hookah in the old cake hole, and the situation lost its urgent edge. Laura wasn't number one on the old chop-chop list, after all. There'd be time to help her out of this fix after dinner.